this time you can ask questions or have a discussion. So it's up to you now. The ball is in your court.
You say that emotions should be recognized as this is how it is. But can you give some advice on actually dealing with a very destructive emotion of anger?
Yeah, I'm an expert on that emotion. Yes, because this is like anger is a natural emotion. You know, it's a part of the package of being human. So it's, you know, and you can see that it's, you know, like the animal kingdom has it. Dogs get angry, cats get angry, and human beings get angry. But then the suffering that we create is we have values and standards, you know, like you shouldn't show anger, you shouldn't get angry, or anger is a bad thing, or you're a bad person because you get angry. And so anger becomes an experience that we often frightened of, like, I found, well, I was very frightened of my own anger. Because I was brought up in a family where we were not allowed to show anger. You know, so you're not supposed to get angry and that. So you learn, as a child, learn to repress the emotion. And then you become frightened of it because it bursts out oftentimes in embarrassing situations. But and then you take it personally as if something I shouldn't, you know, I'm a bad person for being angry. So that's the intellect, isn't it? The superego saying, you shouldn't be angry, and you shouldn't have said that, and you shouldn't have, that was wrong, and you're bad because you said something unkind and cruel and so forth. And then you feel guilty and feel guilty about it and get frightened. So this is like awareness is like a floodlight. You're suddenly lighting up the stage of this drama so you can see all aspects of it. By learning to just reflect on, recognizing that anger is a kind of natural emotion to the species. It's not just you and where on a personal level we can be so caught in the sense of it's my fault, my weakness, my flaw, that we may not recognize it as just a part of the human experience. And that's why I encourage you to reflect on what being human really is. Not from an ideal level of what it should be, but that, you know, having a body, having a sensitive, you know, senses, being conscious, having a retentive memory, you remember things. So you can remember probably all kinds of humiliating experiences where you got angry and said things you shouldn't and so forth, and then you feel guilty and self-disparaging feel despair about yourself. So this is where turning on the light, the floodlight, waking up, in other words, you begin to notice this anger. Don't see it so much. Don't see it anymore as some personal flaw, but it's something you learn from. A lot of wisdom will develop in you from understanding anger. And so, in my own experience, as I began to recognize what mindfulness really is, then I could, before I really understood mindfulness, really recognized a natural state of mindfulness, then I tended to control my emotional life a lot because I was afraid of it. And being in a position like being a Buddhist monk where you have a public image and people expect a lot from you, at least you think they do. So you don't want to look bad and show anger in front of them. So you find it very threatening oftentimes, especially when somebody's challenging me. Somebody's contending with me and says things that make me angry. I try to avoid, used to avoid all that, or dread it, or fear that it might happen. But then when I began to really understand, recognize mindfulness, then I could accommodate anger into that. And so this is why when I teach, I'm pointing to this stillness, the natural stillness that one can recognize as you kind of be more aware of yourself. And not in the critical way, but just opening and observing, being attentive to the reality of this moment. Now, I'm sitting here. I can naturally receive, recognize this still, what I call sound of silence, a kind of resonating, seems like a sound or a vibration of some sort. It's natural. It's not created by me. It's not imagined. By recognizing this, and from there, then I have perspective on the anger, that tendency to get angry. So if I try to control the anger through my personality, then I just reinforce the whole fear reaction to it. But when I trust in awareness, mindfulness, then I have space for anger, because I'm not just controlling it. I'm recognizing it in the reality as it arises, and that awareness is not angry. And you begin to see, if I rest in this awareness, then the anger arises according to situations where that emotion is brought up. But my relationship to it changes from becoming angry to recognizing anger. And it might sound complicated, but it's really very simple. But it does, as you understand yourself better, then the problem will resolve itself. But, being afraid of anger made me dread a lot about when, wanting to control. I'd be pick and choose life situations where I could avoid any possibility of anything that might make me angry. Well, that's a hard way to live, it makes you a bit feckless and cowardly, because it's hard to just live your life in a way that nothing, anger never arises.
Can I say something? It's a question, but I found it all my life I couldn't get angry, and in the end I didn't know when I was angry, and it's taken me years to try to get in touch with that emotion. Of course, in the end I was extremely ill. And this sort of sitting on this resentment, which I suppose anger is repressed, resentment is repressed anger. And I really was very ill. And this was really the cause, feeling very inadequate, very insecure, suicidal for about 2 years. And I've had a lot of help from a psychotherapist. And she said, I'm giving you permission to be angry. And how much damage it can do. I mean, obviously, there's different ways of expressing anger, and you don't sort of go off the deep end. But I sat on it, and it really became an acute anxiety state. I was about 2.5 stone thinner than I am now. And I covered all the mirrors up with brown paper and blue tack, so I couldn't actually look at myself. So this was sort of sitting on this. And as I say, I became really ill. So it ain't worth it.
And now you...
Oh, well, I'm feeling fine now. But it's a long, hard slog. I've really worked really hard to change that. But I'm still working on it.
Yeah.
Because I realise how much time I've spent being resentful about quite trivial things. So I'm having to really be honest, which is quite hard.
Yeah, because that's where, like, learning to listen to all the resentments.
I was afraid of being angry.
Yeah, exactly. It's frightening. And also it's one sees it in a very personal way, something, you know, a personal flaw. And it tends to isolate, doesn't it? You know, you separate yourself from everyone else.
It's not approved of.
Yeah.
I mean, children often being accused of being rude. They're not. They're just being honest.
Yeah.
They're very touched with their emotions.
Well, honesty is often very rude. That, you know, learning, it's a willingness to allow anger into consciousness without judging it. It's like this, you know. So otherwise we judge it, you know, say, oh, that's angry, that's silly, I shouldn't get angry over something like that. Or these resentments, they're so petty. They're so silly. I'm so embarrassed about it. I can't, you know, I hope nobody can listen, mind read. But so there's always this judgment of, you know, some kind of it's silly or stupid or shouldn't. But this is where with the mindfulness, you're actually willing to let even stupidity and foolishness into consciousness. It's not picking and choosing and selecting anymore, but it doesn't matter if it's intelligent or stupid or right or wrong. It is what it is. If you trust that, then that's resolving the problem. You're not creating any more karma with that condition. And then you find anger actually is like a friend to you, rather than a curse in your life.
A very distorted idea that if you love someone, it's crazy, I think, see now. If you love someone, you never got angry with them, when, of course, they're the most lovely part of the angry anyway.
Yes. Anyone you live with.
Yes.
You get most angry with. Yes.
Well, that doesn't mean on that basis, you must still love me. You've been very angry. And I can vouch for you, that's true. But my question has to do with, we're talking here from the standpoint of expressing the anger ourselves, and you mentioned karma there. My question has to do with the effect, kind of karmic effect, if you will, of expressing that anger within that situation, you know, in terms of even the first precept, non-harming. I'm not judging the state of being angry, because how we receive that is also down to our practice. But that's the basis of my question. And also alongside that, within the frame of reference of ordination, how that squares, you know, with the vinaya.
Well, the you know, like, we right speech and right action, right livelihood. This is the sila level, or about action and speech. It's not about mental, not about emotion. So, you know, we're you know, if I, you know, like, we might feel angry, want to curse and swear, but we refrain from cursing and swearing. Developing right speech. towards in terms of activity, outward activity towards the towards others. But then sometimes, you know, like in cathartic methods, when people have repressed anger a lot, then sometimes in therapy they use catharsis, which it has a value too, because it's a cathartic method of just shouting and screaming and cursing. Is maybe, you know, you're not doing it at anybody, you know, to harm them. You're not, you know, your intention is not to hurt somebody or harm anything, but to allow yourself to express maybe resentment, repression, in a very, you know, in an uncensored way, because maybe you've never been able to do that, never allow yourself to really express it. So then catharsis sometimes helps in the beginning, but it's not a technique that lasts long, because you know, you just don't want to have to do that all the time. But it tends to release oftentimes the original blocks. But in terms of right and wrong, like there's skillful and unskillful, and this is in regards to speech and action. And then in terms of conditioning of the mind, emotional habits, it's not, we're just encouraged to act, to do what's good and refrain from doing what isn't. And so this is more like the five precepts, the eight precepts of Bhikkhu Vinaya. So then your relationship to the society is you know, acting on good impulses, generosity, kindness, so forth, and then but that doesn't mean that you always feel that way towards the society. But the other, wanting to hit them and bump them off, and is you don't do that, even though you might feel it in moments. So, then the awareness is recognizing that all conditions are impermanent and not self. So, wanting to help others and wanting to kill others are conditions that arise and cease in consciousness. And so, the awareness of this, that awareness is then the refuge, you know, not in just trying to be a good person that doesn't break the laws or doesn't act violently or brutally in the society, but it's being, you know, recognizing the natural state of awareness, the liberation through this, through resting in this state, and then your relationship to the society on a physical level, on a verbal level, is to, you know, to do good in it, to help, to serve, and then refrain from doing things that harm the society or individuals, creatures. Does that answer your question?
Somewhat. But I remember I was talking with you one time about the story of Milarepa, without going into that, and the difference between using anger insightfully with mindfulness, which is what I'm sure happened the time you were very angry. Because that's a teaching tool. One's aware of the process within a certain environment. And hopefully I have a little bit of training, a little bit, to be able to help me work with that skillfully within that context. But even so, you know, the expression of anger at large has a very harmful effect physiologically on both parties. So it's fine, I think, if one has enough momentum with the practice of awareness and mindfulness to genuinely not be attached to the wrong motivation, to come from right intention. But oftentimes that's not so possible, in which case the anger becomes a foolish weapon, in inverted commas. A weapon of ignorance, not a means of skillfully offering teaching.
Right, but I mean, it's that's the intellectual. And the thing is that these conditions happen. Quoting Donald Rumsfeld, stuff happens. So that is just the way it is. There's a cycle, like anger and guilt, and reinforce the ego, where if the and if you don't break through that cycle, then you just reinforce the ego, by speaking in anger or things like that. So, with Milarepa, I don't know, just theoretical, but it can be, like a skillful means, because the cycle isn't, it's not from the ego anymore. It's just a spontaneous response appropriate to the moment. Or it can be, if carried in the mind, then it becomes a sense of identity, of judgment, of where the ego then is reinforced. Like sometimes, like yelling at a child walking into a busy street. You have to shout and say, don't drag him back. And if you just said, well, he'll be traumatized if I shout at him. He might get hit by a car. Yes?
I've been learning a process where, with anger, they talk about the anger comes from your short thinking. So if you get some distance on it and kind of learn, become more familiar with what the triggers are.
Yeah.
Underneath the anger, there's probably a softer feeling like sadness or fear. And once you're in touch with that, once you're out of the situation, maybe then you can come in with how you'd like to address
the situation from a calmer, more connected space in
yourself,
rather than
acting out of the anger. I mean, that's with practice.
Yeah, well, that like greed, hatred, and delusion. And this is a Buddhist jargon. Lopa dosa moha. These are the kind of the center of the world. And so if you look at this, there's one of these Tibetan tankas with like a mandala of six realms, and it's a kind of circle, and in this circle are these six realms, and in the very center is a pig, rooster, and a snake. And that is, these stand for lopa dosa moha, greed, hatred, and delusion. So this is a Buddhist explanation. So this is when we're born into manifest, incarnate in a human body, then this is part of the package. This you get, as part of getting born in this realm. And so then you as you're conditioned through your parents and carers and peers and so forth, then you get your identities and you're conditioned to think in terms of you'll be rewarded for obeying and you'll be punished for disobeying, and you pick up all the signs of the dualistic structure of reward and punishment. and people like you if you're a certain way, they don't like you if you're not, and if you show anger, then people don't like you. And so, you know, then we repress, because we, you know, most of us want to be liked by others. So you learn to repress a lot of emotions, and it's it becomes habitual. So you're not really, it's not like intentionally repressing. It becomes kind of automatic, it's a habit. And like you were saying, you didn't even know you were angry.
It took me a long time to learn, actually. In a therapist situation, I've been sitting on a very bad experience for 30 years, and I had got no idea that I was angry in front of the sisters in the hospital. And the therapist just kept saying to me, just let the feelings come. And that's the only time I did go a bit hysterical for about 20 minutes, and I was just so angry, but I didn't have a clue that I was. That's 30 years I've been sitting on that.
I know. Afterwards, you wonder, why was I so slow? It seems so obvious once you're released, isn't it?
I think I try to eliminate should and ought out of my vocabulary. Because I used to think I ought, because I went to college not too long ago. I ought to write my essay. But if I say I could write my essay, it gives me a freedom of choice. Whereas otherwise, if I say I should do it, I'm up against the wall and I haven't anywhere to go. So if I have a choice, I'm more likely to do it if I could say could than if I should.
Yeah, but that's exploring how words do affect, you know, how they make you feel. Like this should and ought, you know, even to me, you should practice hard, and I. You know, it's like the school teacher or the Master Sergeant, and so this learning to teach meditation, like in Thailand, for example, where I live, they taught in a much different way than I do, because it's like kill the kilesas, kill these defilements. Kilesas are defilements, and fight against this kind of warrior language, and so when this is what I heard, and operating on that warrior way didn't work for me, because I'm already conditioned for that, and fighting and resisting, and that is what my, I'm conditioned to do. So what I needed was a different way of thinking, and saying, fight the kilesas, fight your defilements, kill them. They say, kill them, kakile. So that didn't work for me, because I'm very good at killing kilesas. I had to learn how to accept, this kind of smarmy New Age language is accepting. It was part of me kind of resist using it. It does have a point to it, like that side of me of receptivity never been developed. It was always, get rid of this, get hold of this, get rid of that. And then if it's bad, you get rid of it. If it's good, you try to hold on. And then in the learning to just even think in a different way, like metta practice, I found helpful, where metta, loving kindness, because metta is indiscriminate. And even in the formal ways of spreading loving kindness, there's no preferences. It's not just spreading love to the good people, but it's receiving the Lord of Death and the devils and the baddies, as well as the angels and the devadas and the good ones. And so, what does that do? Just think about that. That unconditioned love is you can't. It's, they're not liking or approving, is it? You can't approve of a serial killer or like somebody that's really rude and nasty, but you can receive them. You see, so without creating aversion and anger and resentment, and so that helped me to you know, I found this was a more skillful way of even thinking about to myself. But it was a challenge because I wasn't conditioned for this. I was conditioned the other way. You know, like you brought up as a Christian, like I was, it's very much fight the devil, beat the devil, kill the evil forces, exterminate the axis of evil. I can't help it. It's just part of the culture. But then emptiness, you know, like in what you were saying, when you oftentimes let go of the greed hatred, because these are the stronger kind of, like greed is very strong, you know, and anger and hatred are very strong. But delusion, oftentimes quite subtle. And so there's a sense of loneliness, sadness, that you begin to recognize in when these stronger emotions are no longer dominating your consciousness. And this sadness, loneliness is also, you know, another, you know, in terms of practicing with it, is to be aware of it and accept it. And then that also drops away, and what's left is stillness, which is, but it's not a dead stillness. You're not like, you know, kind of paralyzed and petrified as an ice block of ice, but it's a stillness to receive that is never destroyed by the changing conditions you're experiencing through your emotions or mental world. So I noticed in my own life just the you know, going through periods of great loneliness and sadness in monastic life, and then as the kind of stronger, you know, the greed and the hatred resolve themselves, and then they're left with this sense of loneliness and sadness, and then that eventually dropped. But maybe, you know, we do, like modern life is very much aimed at sex and violence, you know, like modern entertainment, isn't it? Blockbusters. What about sex and violence? Why? Because these are very exciting experiences. You know, so, men fighting each other, you know, exploding bombs and planes crashing into buildings, and all this is very exciting to the consciousness. And then sex also very excites. We feel alive and powerful with it. So these are what the modern society praises is to, you know, the sex and violence, or the greed, trying to make us greedy, as greedy as possible, and to wanting us to really take sides, like hate the enemy, you know, really get in there and try to kill off the terrorists and destroy Osama bin Laden. And say we must have metta for Osama bin Laden. Probably, I mean, if you were in the States, I don't think in England they'd care that much, but in the States you'd probably be put in prison. In Guantanamo Bay, maybe. And forgotten there. Yes.
I wanted to know, what is the basis for true friendship?
Not to expect it or demand it. Like, ultimately, we're alone, aren't we? Like, this, you know, existentially, I'm here and you're there. And you come and go, and I stay. So, I mean, you know, this is, and then friendships, you know, with others and their relative, and you idealize true friendship as, you know, my best friend, and this, our friendship will last forever is an ideal. But the reality is friendship arises and ceases according to conditions. And so that recognizing that just the way it is, that consciousness, you're in my consciousness, in terms of the reality of this moment from me sitting here. So I see you. You're in my conscious experience right now. I can't see my own face. I can see yours. I can see your eyes, but I can't see my own. And this kind of reflecting is putting in the way it is in terms of experience. Existence is like this. And then we idealize friendship, you know, we'd long for it, and maybe we become cynical, or we're constantly looking for true friends, things like this, but this is another form of desire, dunha, wanting to that loneliness that I was talking about. Can be a kind of forgotten when you're with your best friend. So the aim then is to not seek just distraction through friendship, but through being aware. And then the friendships evolve more from, you know, in ways that are undemanding and non-clinging, non-attached. So like, you remember as a boy, you know, you always had a best friend, little boys. And, you know, they would change from time to time, the best friend. My real pal, my best friend, my buddy. And then this was appropriate behavior maybe when you're a child. Because you're learning from that. But then in adult life, sometimes that's never, one is looking for the same relationships, the same sense of my best friend, special friend. And then you might have, you know, in moments you find somebody might come into your life who you have great affinities with and heart connections, and you feel this enormous rapport. But then we can hang on to that and demand from it, and so it even destroys the potential there. It's the clinging and demanding and blindness that happens in that relationship if we're not developing awareness. And then we can also think, if you're my real friend, you'll stick up for me even when I'm wrong. Even if I do something wrong, if you're my best friend, you stand up for me. And then you say, I can't because you've broken the law, and I can't. You're not my friend. You don't do what I want. So the best friend, like in Sangha life, for example, just a monastic Sangha is... And it's interesting when you're living with others, with monks and nuns, because you don't really choose these friends. They come. And oftentimes, you know, they're so different and so strange. that you wish you had more selective choice. But then, but reflecting on the Sangha life, where I found, having to relate to people, I found difficult and oftentimes didn't like very much, or didn't understand. And because of that, then there was always having to expand, from, say, when I was a layman, I had a much more narrow margin of acceptability, who I regarded as, who I could be friends with and who I wanted to be with. It was quite narrow, I realized. And then in monastic life, you keep having to expand it, where, it includes everybody then. There's room for everybody in awareness. Because you learn from everyone. You're learning from the dislike you might have for somebody, or your critical way you tend to see them or react to them. Your attraction, your repulsion, and brings up your own opinions about people. And here it's like very international. So you're living with Asian monks, with European, American, Australian, South African, and then generations. I sometimes find it difficult to understand the young generation, because they think so differently than my generation. I realize I'm like a dinosaur or something. I'm a Neanderthal caveman. I'm from a previous age. Why do I react like that? Why do they think like that? And then I realize, a lot of the things that I just take for granted from my background mean nothing to younger people. And that's just the way society changed, like the society now. Like, I was born in 1934, so then the 30s, the world was very different than the expected behavior for Americans was very, very different than what it is now. And the expectation for life and so forth was, the society itself America was not a superpower then, and the attitudes and that were conditioned into me when I was a child, still affect how I see things in terms of the thinking mind. But in terms of awareness, then this is where we're one. In awareness, this awareness is a unitive reality. It's not a divisive thing. Your thinking mind divides. You say, this is my friend, this isn't my friend, this is my best friend, this is my worst enemy. And that's dividing, isn't it? And then with awareness, because it's not discriminative, it's unitive. The union, the oneness, the real oneness, consciously experience through awareness. That's the gate. That's the escape hatch from the divisive, changing conditions that we tend to be identified with. So, like oneness, there's nothing more simple than that. One. Two, then it gets complicated. So one I call universe, unity. But it's in terms of sensory consciousness right now, it's the sensory consciousness divides. So my eye sees you, you're an object. This is from this position of seeing. You are objects in my vision. Then the oneness. Now that's on the conventional level of conditioned phenomena. Then the oneness is the awareness of that. That awareness has no identity. I can't claim it in any personal way. It's not a personal thing. My personality is conditioned and changes according to other conditions. But awareness brings you, puts you in, lets you rest in a natural state. Oneness, universal oneness, which you can't imagine. There's no image for it. But it's real. It's a fact. It's not an abstract metaphysical theory. But what is it? And this is what the liberation from suffering is all about. Because that division is the suffering. Being identified with all this separateness and conflict and opposites and emotional conditions and thoughts and being identified and lost in the conditioned realm is the suffering of the dukkha. And then the awareness of this is the oneness. And so that's where the all conditions resolve themselves in that. You know, so friendship or enemies or whatever, you know, friends, enemies, people that I have affinity with, people I don't have any affinity, these are conditions that change. And they, you know, we can call them conventional realities. They're conventions, but not to empower them is with something more than that. They are what they are, and then we no longer make that into a problem, create a problem about the way the changing conditions are changing. Yes.
You mentioned before that you had a kind of a moment when you became mindful. How and when did the penny drop in terms of mindfulness for you?
Well, when I started, I didn't know. I didn't have a clue what mindfulness was. And even though, you know, I thought I understood the word, when I actually learned how to concentrate my mind when I first started meditating, before I was a monk, and I lived in Bangkok. So I learned concentrating, and so samadhi was the big word then. Do you have samadhi? And of course, samadhi, to a English-speaking person, is like a Hindu kind of achievement. You know, in Thailand, oftentimes it just means concentration. You know, because that's what it actually means. But if you come from my background, then samadhi is like, you know, nirvikalpa samadhi is some great achievement that only the advanced Hindu yogis can do. And so then they say, do you have samadhi? And I say, no, not at all. But actually, I was quite good at samadhi because that's how my mind's conditioned to concentrate. And so then I started with this technique called the Burmese technique, where you do everything in slow motion. So I thought that was mindful, doing everything in slow motion. So when I became a Samanera, novice monk, I was in this monastery in the northeast, and everybody was walking in slow motion. Everything was slow motion. And so everything, you couldn't, mindfulness was like that. And so... So one time I had to go to Bangkok, you know, for a visa. And I said, how can you practice mindfulness if you're on a train going to Bangkok? And how can you be mindful when you're in Bangkok? You can't walk slowly like that in Bangkok. And they said, you can't do it in Bangkok. So I kind of lost interest in that practice. You know. I mean, I don't want to spend the rest of my life moving that slowly. So then I had to consider, you know, and then I read, you know, some books on in the scriptures, suttas, and then I figured it out. You know, I did a lot of the year that I was a samanera. I really had the insight the first year because I used that Four Noble Truths, and I began to recognize, you know, this natural state of awareness, and that wasn't, you know, I wasn't creating, it wasn't through concentrating the mind. So I could, you know, I concentrate in the mind, I can get very still and tranquil, but it's easily disrupted. You know, it throws me off. Every door slams or something happens, or you doubt it. You know, you doubt is a big obstruction to getting the jhanas. So, you know, I have a very skeptical mind, so I'd be in this state. And then I thought, is this first jhana or second? Then it'd be gone. So you're reading a list off out of a book from an ignorant mind, unenlightened mind, and then trying to get what you think you should from the way you interpret the scripture, and it was a hopeless task. So then the insight was, you know, through these Four Noble Truths, I explored suffering, dukkha, and the causes and the cessation of it. And when I actually began to recognize non-attachment and as a reality rather than just assuming that I'm always attached to something, I became aware of emptiness, of where the thinking process stops, of absence of space. And so then from that point, then the following year, I took higher ordination, went to stay at Ajahn Chah. And his whole emphasis was on ordinary movement and mindfulness in the life of a Buddhist monk. So then I was, you know, lived with him for about 10 years, where the mindfulness wasn't encouraging concentration that much, but awareness of especially around mental state, like living in the Thai monastery. At first was very frustrating because I didn't understand the language, and you know, moving from a Western environment to a very traditional, strict forest monastery with a different language and everything different. So there's a lot of emotion aroused, a lot of frustration and exasperation and so forth. So I had a lot of emotional reactions to the life. And then he was very skillful at getting me to observe. He didn't tell me I was wrong for feeling frustrated or... But he would use it, my frustration to get me to look at it and started noticing, you know, how I create endless problems around if I can't understand what they're saying or if I, you know, feeling, you know, the suspicions or doubts and all that. So that, you know, the attention was always toward looking at what's happening rather than trying to defend or blame, or what I would tend to do on my conditioned mind. You know, I would either feel defensive or blaming, critical, or feeling I can't do this. You know, and you adjusting, totally adjusting to something so different. But with that mind, then living here in England now, for many years. You know, it's all become more and more as you develop and cultivate it, then it's so obvious. And then sometimes you feel impatience with others. because can't you see it? Well, I think that should be enough for now.